Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George Gordon, Lord Byron, was born with a beautiful face and a club foot. He would write some of the world's most treasured lines of love poetry and give romance both a good and bad name. His friend Mary Shelley may have had him in mind when she wrote Frankenstein. Byron lusted and loved without discrimination, choir boys, cobblers' wives, countesses, a half-sister, and hundreds more by his own account. He lived fast and died young at 36 in 1824, a 19th century celebrity. This hour On Point, Irish novelist Edna O'Brien on Lord Byron in love. You can join the conversation. Do you know half the stories of this man and his wild, wonderful, dark passions? Would Madonna, Mick Jagger, Michael Jackson hold a candle to Lord Byron for flamboyant sexuality celebrity? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from London is Edna O'Brien, acclaimed novelist and the author most recently of the biography Byron in Love, A Short, Daring Life. Edna O'Brien, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, and hello.
What do you think Lord Byron would have thought of our contemporary celebrities with their very public sexual peccadilloes, indiscretions, infamy?
Well, I suppose he would have, he would be amused. But the one thing to remember about him as a celebrity or an outlaw or whatever word we choose was that he believed and espoused the power of thought, the power of the mind, and the magic that imagination can yield or induce. Not every celebrity, I fear, is obsessed with the power of thought. I don't know what you think.
I think you're exactly right, though they would clearly, anyone who looks back has to see also the power of his attraction to the whole world of passion and love. I wonder if you would be kind enough to read for us just from the very beginning of your first chapter to get the man on the table a little bit with us, if you would, Edna O'Brien.
Okay. Lord George Gordon Byron was 5 feet 8.5 inches in height, had a malformed right foot, chestnut hair, a haunting pallor, temples of alabaster, teeth like pearls, grey eyes fringed with dark lashes, and an enchantedness that neither men nor women could resist. Everything about him was a paradox, insider and outsider, beautiful and deformed, serious and facetious, profligate but on occasion miserly, and possessed of a fierce intelligence, trapped, however, in a child's magic and malices. What he wrote concerning the poet Robert Burns could easily serve as his own epitaph. Tenderness, roughness, delicacy, coarseness, sentiment, sensuality, dirt and deity, all mixed up in that one compound of inspired clay. He was also a gigantic poet. But as he reminds us, poetry is a distinct faculty and has no more to do with the individual than has the pythoness when she is off her tripod. Byron, off his tripod, becomes Byron the man, who by his own admission could not exist without some object of love.
Edna O'Brien joining us from London and reading there from the very opening of her book, Byron in Love, A Short, Daring Life. Now, you're not a psychologist, but many have jumped in with Oedipal and many other kinds of explanations for his, I don't know what you'd call it, compulsion when it came to love. How do you explain that he could not exist without some object of love?
Well, it's complex, but I think some of the clues. I think love begins for all of us, whether we're poets or carpenters, begins in childhood, in the cradle. Byron's early life was very, well, Ed was very humble, famished, but it was also traumatic. He was born in a room above a shop near Oxford Street in London. Of his mother, Catherine, young woman, had been an heiress, but was quickly relieved of all her monies and her salmon fisheries and her all her everything, her possessions, by Byron's father, Mad Jack, who by then had fled what I can hardly call the family nest. A mother and son moved to Aberdeen, where they also lived above a shop. Now, Byron was this prodigy and very precocious and read a lot. And his mother, who I suppose did love him, also was wild-tempered. And his biggest affliction, not just as a child, but through his whole life, was his lameness. And he believed that his lameness was a form of castration and that he had been given the curse of Cain, for which he blamed that mother, which was quite unfair.
Saying that she had worn her corsets too tight in pregnancy.
Too tight, yes. And he wrote 20 years afterwards, very early on, he conceived of a poem called The Deformed Transformed, and spoke about the feats of, physical and everything that a deformed person, which secretly he felt he partially was. So that would be one source. But the other, equally important, poets are nearly always in love. And feel that, I remember Andrei Voznesensky, the Russian poet, saying to me once, poets have to be in love to write. And the third thing, and they're only, again, very summary, I'm sure there are deeper reasons, was that Byron was irresistible. He was irresistible to men and to women. He was beautiful. Coleridge said his smile was like the temple opening of temple gates. Everybody who saw Byron fell, literally fell, at grand soirees in the great houses in Regency England at that time. Women fainted when Byron arrived. So love pursued him, and he pursued love. But it's also fair to say that he did quite a lot of damage en route.
When I think of him, of women swooning when he arrived, this was partly just because of his physical presence, never mind the clubfoot, the effect he had on people.
Well, the clubfoot even helped slightly, because although everything about him was perfect, there was, as in the fairy tale, one stigma or one wound. And he had this dark look, the underlook, it was called by the women who fainted or half fainted.
I love that phrase, the underlook. What did that mean exactly?
Well, I think it's I've wondered myself. I think it's in it there is a not looking the other person in the eye and looking downwards with a certain disdain or even contempt.
You know, I hate to bring it back to contemporary celebrities, but I can't help thinking how he helped build that reputation. He had the immediate physical effect on people. That was pretty clear from everything you and many others have reported. But he did help
he
build
it.
The Child Herald, the Cantos of the Child Herald he wrote.
He built it very consistently. He both sought celebrity and publicity, the words that are nowadays hackneyed. He sought it and then ran from it. So he knew the game very well, which was to tantalize, to show, then to hide, then to reappear. He boxed and fenced every day. He kept himself very fit. He dressed very well. He loved grandeur, his carriages, and his. He had very much domestic taste, but he liked to have everything ornamental, and he did cultivate it, but it again left him in some ways unsatisfied. He wrote a poem, which I might be able to find, but I hope I will, but I can paraphrase it if I don't.
Yes.
In which he asked the question, what is fame? And he answered, what is fame? 'Tis but to fill a certain portion of uncertain paper. For this men write, speak, preach, and heroes kill, and bards burn what they call the mere midnight taper, to have, when the original is dust, a name, a wretched picture, and worse bust. So you could see the ambiguity, because he was so fiercely intelligent and self-aware, and to some extent merciless to his own moral failings. He was so astute, and yet fame was the drug that he could not resist.
He wrote like an angel, famously these lines: "She walks in beauty like the night, of cloudless climes and starry skies, and all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and her eyes." And yet you write, Edna O'Brien, he could be practically a werewolf capable of monstrous cruelty.
He was capable of both. Just for a minute, Tom, to stay with that poem quoted, and I'm so glad you did. He wrote that poem in one night, fueled, not unsurprisingly, with brandy. He was at yet another soiree in some grand house. I think it was Lady Sitwell's in London. And he saw a cousin of his, distant cousin, Lady Anne Wilmot, whom he had not seen for years. And she was in mourning. And she was wearing a black dress with spangles, and something about her, being a widow, her husband young and had died in one of the wars, and something about her demeanor that was both so mournful and beautiful, captivated him, and he came home.
And all these centuries later have the beauty of that. Edna O'Brien, please stand by. The book is Byron in Love. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
That tender light which heaven to God he denies, she walks in beauty like the night of cloudless climes and starry skies.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Lord Byron, the lover, the poet, and his wild, by any standard, passions. Edna O'Brien is with us, Irish novelist and author of the new book Byron in Love, A Short Daring Life, and it is quite a story. It's romantic. It's absolutely hair-raising. Edna O'Brien joins us from London. I think Americans may not know the cruel side as well as they know the romantic side. We'll go to it, but I wish you'd read just a little bit more for us first, if you would, Edna O'Brien, from the effect he had, as you say, on men and women, but there's a passage here on women in particular, when he would walk in.
When he would walk in to one of the great houses, Byron was swamped by women, all seeing him as the archetype of Childe Harold.
And this was his own work, Childe Harold's Pilgrimage.
Despite his every camouflage not to be, there was something cold and fastidious about Byron's bearing. Yet the effect of his arrival in those places was dizzying. Hearts fluttered, senses went haywire. Lady Rosemary almost fainted. And Lady Mildmay said that when he spoke to her in a doorway, her heart beat so violently that she could hardly answer him. What can he have said? His underlook, as it was termed, excited them, as indeed did the rumours that he was an infidel and dreadfully perverted. His lameness, while evoking pity, also quickened desire. The combination of genius and Satanism was irresistible. Each and all thirsting for an introduction, if only to receive a lash of his bitter tongue, or maybe, feature in one of his lays. He was, as those who wrote to him or saw him or tried to speak to him, he was poet, devil, and God, attributes that appeal to every woman.
Wow, Edna O'Brien reading from Byron in Love. All right, there he is coming to the great house. But I want to convey some of just how terrible he could be. There's a moment in the book you describe him in one of these great houses. He's standing before the mantle of the fireplace, I think. His pregnant half-sister, Augusta, is there. He's glaring out at this point at almost everybody else who's there, and they're glaring back at him. And this is just before he left England forever.
Forever. But, Tom, that was a pivotal and terrible moment in Byron's life. He was only, it was when his disgrace after the incestuous relationship with his half-sister and cruelty to his wife after a marriage of 1 year, he sent her out of the house with a newborn child. All that was made public in papers and cartoons. Byron was, as you said in your introduction, regarded as Caligula, the second Nero. He was a pariah. He couldn't actually go out of his house, which was now, of course, the bailiffs were in the hall. He couldn't go out because of the mob who would attack him. He did, however, at one night, just before he left England, with Augusta, accept an invitation from a woman, Lady Jersey. Mm. She was the only one of all his friends, or erstwhile friends, who would receive him. And when he went into that room, the people were appalled. They scattered. They, again, fainting, but of a different kind. And Byron did something very brave and sad and salutary. He saw the hypocrisy of the world that had welcomed and embraced and fawned over him. And he leant on the mantelpiece and looked out at them with contempt, but also with hurt. And that night, I would say, was one of the occasions, there were probably more, in which his separation from England meant something deep to him, and which was the trigger for future work that he would write. He would write another more cantos of Childe Harold, in which he talked of wounds that could not be, wounds that were there forever. But I think the phrase was, wounds which kill not, but wrung with the wounds which kill not, but never heal. So although Byron was mad, bad and dangerous to know, as Caroline Lamb had put it, he was also in many ways very wronged and very, and he was a wounded man. He was wronged by his peers because there was a great jealousy of him. The reviews of Byron's work unceasingly, not just at one or two or three occasions, were vitriolic. Fellow poets, apart from Shelley, were very biting in about Byron. Keats hated Byron. But not only Keats or Wordsworth, critics of the time felt Byron's truthfulness, Byron's mercilessness, Byron's showing up the underbelly of his own society, or for that matter, in Oriental Tales, any other society, was too much for England to stomach.
Harold Bloom writes about him as fallen angel and ultimate rock star, writes about his audacious wickedness, his polymorphous perversity. Many have noted, Byron is lucky. He's been written of many times, but he's lucky to have you on this subject. I mean, you're a very sympathetic biographer here, but please lay out for us. You sort of skated over the outrages that had everyone standing across the hall from Byron and him alone at that mantelpiece. I mean, his relationship with his half-sister, tell us more, and also the triangle, unwanted by his wife, of himself, his half-sister, and his new wife, even to hear today, I mean, it puts any sort of Rolling Stone stories to shame.
Yeah, well, it was. It was, he fell in love with his half-sister without realizing it. It was before he was married, but it continued. Henry James has spoken of it because he was fascinated by that triangle, and especially the love of Augusta, the half sister,
and not a platonic love. This is a child creating love.
As James said, it was abnormal, and of course it was sexual, but James called it a sacred compunction. Mm-hmm. Now I'm not sure about the sacred, but there was certainly compunction and compulsion in it. As he said, she came to his rooms. By then he was famous, and she was married to a cad who was yet off again at some race course. She came to borrow money from Byron. He brought her to one of these houses, showed her off, brought her some clothes the next day. And before long, they were lovers. Byron said no seduction had ever been so easy. But they were not only lovers, they were in love. And vowing or hoping or intending to go away. In those days in England, when other people had no money or were in trouble, they went to Europe. Europe seemed to take everyone. Mm-hmm. And Augusta balked at the last minute because Byron wouldn't bring her other children. She already had children. She was pregnant, it is thought. It has never been fully proved, but it is thought by Byron. They didn't go away, so they came to an idea that they insanely, I have to use the word because there's no other word for it, that marriage would save Byron. Now, I don't think any marriage would have been the right recipe for that situation. And Byron had proposed some years earlier, well, a year and a half perhaps, to an heiress, a rather plump woman whom he had seen at one of the waltz mornings in London, where she had come down to London. And he thought she was a lady in waiting. But his friend Tom Moore gave him a nudge and said, marry her, and she'll be able to restore Newstead for you. Newstead was his ancestral mythic home with the roof falling in and cows in the kitchen or dining room.
Nevertheless, symbol of all he'd come into when he came into his title, Lord Byron.
Symbol of his grandeur, his ancestral heritage of ghosts, of cloak and dagger tales. It was both gothic and actual, and as I say, falling down. So he proposed via Lady Melbourne, who was his confidant and a witch-like woman in everything. He proposed to Annabel Milbank, or had Lady Melbourne propose. And Annabel Milbank, to show you the kind of person she was, she was asked by Lady Milbank to set down what she would require in a husband. And the list included something anathema to Byron, as you can imagine: duty, strong and generous feelings, reason, economy, manners rather than beauty. And then she added, really, the coup de grace. She said she would not enter into a family where there is a strong tendency to insanity. Well, I'm sorry, she was walking from the frying pan into the fire.
You have to take us to those nights of her honeymoon, so-called, and after, when Augusta and Annabel and Byron were all in the same house, and the sort of really cruel triangle that he created.
Yes, he had a cruel pantomime. Just before we go to the night, the wedding itself, having proposed a second or third time to Annabel and was accepted, Byron shook with terror because he didn't want it. He knew he had made a terrible mistake. But as he said, the men of parchment, meaning the lawyers from both sides, his side and her family's side, were at work. So he went ahead with this grim wedding in her parents' drawing room up in Seaham, a town, Cole Place. And the wedding was in the drawing room because the Archbishop of Canterbury allowed it. It will show you how famous Byron was. He didn't want to be married in a church. And they were on kneelers, and Byron stumbled over the vows. She said hers. She wore grey, which is not unsurprising. And as he was taking the vows, Augusta, meanwhile, was preparing the letter, saying to him, as the earth trembles and the sea swoons or whatever, so she was doing, because she intuitively knew the moment that the marriage had been sealed. So they go in a carriage in the snow, full, again, a gothic fiction scenario, to another of Annabel's father's houses, cold, of course, and there were bells along the way to celebrate the wedding, and he cursed the bells. He also cursed her and said, you have married a devil, and she, telling her she could not even envisage the punishment that lay in store.
And soon enough, she's in this sexual labyrinth, you call it, with Augusta.
On his marriage night, he had, as he told rather crudely Tom Moore, he had Lady Byron on the sofa. But when they went up to bed, Byron very drunk, he had always kept a loaded pistol beside his bed, no matter where or whom he was with. He said to her, she could sleep elsewhere because if she wished to, but he didn't mind sleeping with an animal so long as it was young. So she got into bed beside Byron, none too happy, as you can imagine. And the curtain caught fire, the candle flame. And Byron, it was like a story by Edgar Allan Poe at this moment. Byron believed he was in hell, but in fact he knew he was in hell. And he got up, locked the bedroom door, paced the corridor, shouting that he would kill himself, and firing the pistol. The next morning in the drawing room, he was relatively calm. And she came down, having been dressed by her lady's maid, and her heart already turning to stone. And Byron handed her the letter Augusta he had just received from Augusta. The postal service, as you can see, was quite good in those days, in which Augusta said she knew the moment that he had taken the vows. So he handed this to his new wife, his young wife, and said, did she not think it was a pretty letter, the prettiest letter she could ever have read? Well, she didn't think that. And the first seed of suspicion about his love for his sister was sown in her. She had corresponded with the sister, the half-sister, who wrote, really hypocritically back to her and called her dear sis, and they would be the closest of friends. So now Annabel's suspicions, her hackles, as it's put, were raised. And Byron's, soon after a short while on this honeymoon, this treacle moon, as he called it, announced that they would actually spend the remainder of the time with Augusta in her house near Newmarket in Cambridge.
And he would sleep with Augusta through half the night, with Annabel, his young wife, listening from upstairs?
Above the stairs. And she said, if I had a dagger... She had seen a dagger in some place in the house. She said, if I had had that dagger, it was through her heart I would put it. However, she managed to maintain her sanity and her poise, and even asked Augusta on one of their walks how she could get Byron to love her. And Augusta, was quite subtle, but... mistrustful, untruthful about it. She said that he may never love her, but perhaps he might get to like her. And that was... And then, to just compound the story even further, how we tend to not love our enemies, but are drawn to them. Augusta was the one then... I mean, Annabel was the one then, when things got worse, when she and Byron lived in London, to invite Augusta, because she felt that Augusta was the only one who knew Byron, who understood Byron. And she now knew she was living with a madman.
And it all came to pieces. And he's essentially left in exile from England. And the love life moves to Europe and beyond. He'll go on into Italy and famously then ultimately to his death fighting in Greece, but continuing to cut this huge wide swath of lovers behind him all the way. Judith Thurman calls him a rapacious lover. Is there any doubt in your mind of that phrase for him?
Yes, but I'd also like to point out, Tom, yes, he was rapacious, and he left lovers strewn across many latitudes. But they were obsessed by him. It wasn't just he who... He wasn't... They were as much... followed and smitten by him. Mm-hmm. They all wrote about him. His wife spent the remainder of her life compiling a very self-righteous and, in fact, bitter history of their marriage, his story, as she called it, of their marriage. So it's as you say, when he left England, the first thing he did was to fall upon a chambermaid when they landed in Ostend.
Right.
He was also writing Childe Harold, and there was always comedy attached to Byron. We must remember this, because Byron was very, very funny. His letters are masterpieces of comedy as well as insight. And he had been accompanied. He always had a lot of staff. He just loved the good life, as it's called. And one of them was a physician, Polly Dolly,
yes,
as Byron nicknamed him. And he had been given £500, or guineas, as it was in those days, by Byron's publisher to write about Byron on this journey throughout Europe.
And no, Brian, hold the thought. We'll come to the journey. We have to take a short break here. The book is Byron in Love. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Lord Byron, the lover, the poet, and his wild, by any standard, passions. The Irish novelist Edna O'Brien joins us from London. Her new book is Byron in Love, A Short, Daring Life. And you're hearing some of the tales. He was magnetic. He was cruel. Dean's with us from Hyde Park, Massachusetts. Dean, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment on this, following the reasoning of Byron as a sort of prototypical modern celebrity, bad boy, rock star. I can't help but think of the parallels between, contemporary celebrities who use their fame and their stardom to raise awareness of all kinds of causes, whether they're political or environmental or AIDS in Africa. And then we think of Byron, who used his own celebrity, whose celebrity helped advance the cause of Greek independence.
From the Ottoman Empire. He died in the cause, no less.
He gave his life for it. And he didn't, he certainly didn't do it single-handedly. He was part of a larger movement of Philhellenism, but he certainly played a prominent role in raising awareness of that struggle in European circles.
No question. The politics and the poetry of politics became a big part of his exile in Europe. Edna O'Brien, there's a parallel that we can relate to as we look at celebrities today.
Yes, and he did pay a price. First of all, he paid his own army. From his own money and his own earnings, he doled out masses of money to different Greek factions, all of whom were actually warring with each other and all of whom wanted to be in power. He paid that price, and he paid with his life. He did not, as he would have hoped, die on the battlefield, because the siege of Lepanto, which he had planned, the second siege, not the first one, the first one was centuries before, but the siege which he had planned fell through because his army, the Suelite army, defected on him and asked for higher wages and more weapons. So he died of fever in Missolonghi, in a house that was surrounded by lagoon and swamp. And Byron is a hero. The cause he took, many celebrities take up causes, but Byron actually put himself there in the danger zone point one.
I wanted to ask, as I was reading here, I mean, he had already written when he was, 23, that the best of life was behind him. He'd had so
yes.
many lovers, what, tooled with,
well,
his words, 200
just,
plus in Venice.
It wasn't just because he had lovers that he fell to 23. He was, A, in debt.
Mm.
We must never forget money in
yes.
everybody's life, Tom, or the absence of it.
Yes.
And also, although he was exuberant, he was a very troubled man. He ground his teeth. He bit his nails. He was a man who, for all the ill deeds, which we seem to be mentioning almost too affirmatively, he suffered intense inner moral doubt and despair. And at 23, he did feel that the best of life was over. But then he had this resurrection, which was the one of fame, that he, Childe Harold, as he said, he wakened one morning and found himself famous. Nothing about Byron is simple or straightforward, because he was a hero and he was an anti-hero. He did not really, I think, ever love England with the same deep and mythic love as he did Greece and Turkey and the East. Was as if he had been reincarnated. And going to Greece was an act of utter folly. The army was scattered, the Turks still owned the ports and the more strategic parts of Greece. And even going there, Byron was on a death mission, that is for sure.
But that fame and celebrity brought him a huge audience. By 1814, he was writing The Corsair, sold out its entire first run, all 10,000 copies in London in one day in 1814. This is, of course, the tale of the pirate captain risking the love of his life.
Interesting about Corsair and the hero Conrad. Again, it's linked, as Byron or Conrad the hero puts it, it's linked with one virtue and 1,000 crimes. And that you could say you could go on Byron's own tombstone as well.
All to save a slave from a Turkish harem, maybe a stand-in for Greece there.
Well, we might be reading too much into it, but it was certainly two women, because although he did not love his wife, Annabella, he was still internally absorbed with the fact of being with his wife and his half-sister at the same time. So there is the bride of the story that Conrad deserts and the murderess, Gulnir, whom Conrad saves.
I don't want to lose the beauty of the poetry here, as you essentially say, you know, a little bit from the Corsair. You know, he's talking, whom slumber soothes not, pleasure cannot please. Oh, who can tell, save he whose heart hath tried and danced in triumph o'er the waters wide, the exulting sense, the pulse's maddening play that thrills the wanderer of that trackless way from the Corsair.
That is beautiful, but I'd actually love to read you four lines that he also wrote about love, because we should put them side by side and not emphasize one. For the sword outwears its sheath, and the soul wears out the breast, and the heart must pause to breathe, and love itself have rest.
Oh, great clarity.
So there was more to Byron than I or any biographer or anyone writing a portrait of him could ever unearth.
Read us, if you would.
Because of his complexity.
Yeah, indeed. Read us, if you would, Edna, from his entry into Venice. Here you've got, in 1816, you've got a wonderful passage that describes Lord Byron sort of taking up residence. Yes.
In November 1816, on a foggy night, Byron entered Venice, the greenest isle of his imagination. The black knots of the gondolas in the canal, more beautiful to him than a sunrise, the fairy city of the heart, in which he embarked on a spree of licentiousness. Everything about it was to his liking, the gloomy gaiety of the gondolas, the silence of the city, beauty inseparable from decay, and soon carnival, masquerades, balls, and whores. Within 4 days he had secured a gondola, stabled his horses on the Lido, found an apartment close to St. Mark's Square, and enrolled in the monastery on the island of San Lorenzo to take lessons in Armenian, his mind in need of something craggy, as he said, to torture himself into action. But he had also fallen in love with Mariana Segati, the wife of the landlord, pretty as an antelope, with large black oriental eyes, glossy hair, the voice of a lute, graces, as he said, worthy of the Song of Solomon's. And you see, Tom, he was a romantic,
yeah, no
certainly
kidding.
At first.
Yes.
He wasn't always, he was a romantic. The trouble with him or both, was that these loves paled. And that was due, I think, both to the ravenousness of his imagination and also of his appetite.
And
he claimed Venice to have been, and he boasted shamelessly to his male friends, all of whom remained so fond and so faithful to him. Hobhouse, Tom Moore, Scrope Davis, he boasted of his conquests, and claimed once to have had 200 in one day. Shelley, who was his friend and later less of a friend, was outraged by Byron's licentious life, but could do nothing to stop him, because Byron was determined on this spree. It was as if he was punishing someone or something. With the life he lived for the first few years in Venice. I mean, and Shelley gives a wonderful account, I don't know if you'd let me read it, of going to Palace Mocenigo, where Byron was, and the establishment, besides servants, of 10 horses, 8 enormous dogs, 3 monkeys, 5 cats, right. An eagle, a crow, right. And a falcon. Oh, and Shelley adds, I forgot something in the enumeration in this Circean palace. I have just met on the grand staircase 5 peacocks, 2 guinea hens, and an Egyptian crane.
This menagerie all in Byron's residence in Venice.
Yes.
They were taken with Byron, but appalled by him at the same time. You write, by his debaucheries, consorting, you write, with the most ignorant, the most disgusting, the most bigoted, the most filthy creatures, bargaining with mothers and fathers for their daughters, brazenly naming his conquests from contessas to cobbler's wives, you know, claiming to have tooled with 200 women of one sort or another. this wasn't easy even for poet Shelley, and certainly not for Mary Shelley, and certainly not for her sister. Tell us the story of how he had and abandoned that Claire Clairmont.
Yes, that is the blackest mark and the greatest stain on Byron's memory and legacy. This woman, as this young girl, as he said, came prancing after him, the half-sister of Mary Shelley.
This is the author of Frankenstein, with
child,
of course.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mary Shelley, author of Frankenstein, which was in some ways, I think, inspired by Byron, because they all wrote ghost stories, one when they were in Switzerland in villas nearby after Byron left England. And it was there that Mary Shelley, with Byron's influence, because she said she was not immune mm-hmm. to Byron's powers, began Frankenstein. Anyhow, Clairmont had a child, and Byron agreed after when the child was 2 years to take care of it. The child was brought to the palace in Venice, but very shortly was farmed out to a British consul or any other consul's wife who might take the child. And when Byron fell in love with his last but one love, Countess Teresa Giocoli, a bride of 16, was married to another, a Dracula figure. Mm. The child was sent to a convent, and Byron, where little girl Allegra, where she died not long after, Byron refused to even go to see the remains before the embalming. And yet to England,
his own child taken from her mother by him, left to die essentially in the convent school.
Yes, and he loved pomp, you see, and he wrote to John Murray to say a tablet was to be put, the child was to be buried inside Harrow Church where he had gone to school, and his tablet, you know, with words he had taken from Ecclesiastics. It was, of course, refused because by then Byron was satanic in the minds of not only of English pastors and clergymen, but of the English public.
Edna O'Brien, I wanted to read something, if I could, from the American feminist Katha Pollitt, who reviewed your book for Slate here and liked it a lot. But she, and this is a very prominent and American feminist who, you know, has no compunction about saying just what she thinks about men when she thinks they've gone wrong. But here's what she writes, and I found it interesting. She says, "It's easy to see Byron as a cad, a narcissist, and at bottom a misogynist. But that would be unfair. Byron's great insight," Katha Pollitt writes, "in an era when women were expected to be placid and insipid, not that they were, was to see that women were very much like men. They wanted sex and went after it eagerly, if secretly. Don Juan, his great satiric novel in verse, is a virtual catalog," she writes, "of passionate women who are anything but bashful." Here's Katha Pollitt, our American feminist, in a way welcoming Byron in spite of all his cruelties.
Well, I'm very pleased. I'm astonished and delighted to hear this. I suppose it's saying that Byron opened gates, I won't get too physical here, opened gates and desires in women that had been repressed. I hadn't read this review, but now that you tell me about it, of course I will.
Let me get one call. Bill in Burlington, Vermont. You're on with Edna O'Brien, Bill.
Thanks for taking my call. I would just like to hear you say a few words about Byron as a satirist and a moralist. You just mentioned, I read some lines from Don Juan.
Yes.
I think in the beginning he mentions that he's writing it according to the principles of Aristotle. He, like The Wasteland, which is famous for quoting from other poets, Don Juan is full of quotes from the Latin poets, from Pope, from Milton, from... So if you could, I know there's not much time, but if you could just...
We'll try, Bill. Thank you. Don Juan, Don Juan, as many say.
Could I answer that? Is
please,
that okay?
Please, please.
What I say, Bill, about Don Juan covers or touches on what you have said, and of course, much more. He wrote John Murray with the claim that it was going to be quietly facetious about everything. But, of course, it was not facetious. It was insightful. It was blasphemous and bawdy, but it was shot with indignation of the society around him and with a dazzling erudition. The high romance, steeped in history and resonating with influences of the Old Testament, Virgil, Homer, and everything else, Donny Johnny was one of the most astute observers of mankind. So you are absolutely right too, and I am very glad it came up in the program. He was a satirist from very early on. He satirized many of the poets, Robert Southey and others, whom he thought as toadying to king and crown. But he was also moral in certain areas, perhaps not sexual, not perhaps, not sexually, but in his recognition, for instance, about war. He was totally opposed to the wars in his time and to war, because he saw it as the vanity of leaders, of great generals, and the carnage of the ordinary soldiery. When he went to the field of Waterloo, and he galloped there and went back day after day, and he wrote his greatest poem is about Waterloo, and of enemy of the two sides in one red burial blent, the bloods of each of them at last soaked into the ground after that long battle of Waterloo. So that he was indeed an observer and an extremely moral man about many things.
Edna O'Brien, novelist and biographer here in Byron in Love, A Short, Daring Life. You make that very, very clear, and it doesn't get much richer and or more dappled. Edna O'Brien, we're very grateful to you for spending the hour with us and sharing with us. Thank you so much for your work on Byron and your time today.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry it's over. I was only just beginning to think of a few more things.
Yeah, just warming
thank
up.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll do it again.
Thank you to the listeners.
Thank you so much. Edna O'Brien in London with Byron in Love. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.